You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. Coming up next is that show that you know and love, or maybe that you've never heard of, and or maybe you listened once or twice and you thought it sucked, but whatever the case, it's coming up next, whether you like it or not.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings, listener, and welcome to Technology Bites 90.1.
I know you're going for the citizen reference, but the listener reference is just kind of sad.
Now makes the other three think that they're like eavesdropping on the one.
Just got warm in here.
Man, the Skype sounds great today.
Yeah, well, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
All right, so no technical problems for the intro, because Peter Hughes is in the studio.
As long as CB connection stays good, over.
Yeah.
As long as we don't kill Pete, this show should go smoothly.
What's your 1020? That means location.
Yeah. Way to reference last week.
Was that last week or 2 weeks ago? It was a while back.
I don't want to think about it too hard.
A lot of miles ago.
That was a lot of saying, call 526-5738 ago.
Come on back and talk to Teddy Bear.
On board.
Phantom 409.
Mr. Clean?
And 11 long.
You'll be happy to know that.
In a chartreuse microbus.
You'll be happy to know that in order to help take the studio out into the world, I've actually panned y'all's mic some so that it comes across in stereo as y'all are sitting.
So when somebody's listening, some are hearing.
So you're a little bit on the
left.
He's a little bit on the right, and you're in the middle.
point, counterpoint.
Why do I always have to ride in the middle seat? No, I'm in the middle on the bench.
So it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like Democrat, Republican, and Independent.
tacos.
Benghazi. All right, welcome to the show. We're glad you could tune in. I'm going to turn up my headphones because I would need to hear myself better. There we go. Welcome to Technology Bites. Glad you could tune in. Visit us online at www.geekradio.com. That is our website. Mostly what you'll find there are just announcements about geek gatherings and the podcast, but it's also got information about the show and how to contact us and all that good stuff. So if you want to send a question in via the website, we can take care of those during the week. We don't necessarily take questions over the web via email on the air, because we want you to call in later on when we do the call-in part of the show. And we don't want to encourage people to just kind of like phone it in via email or something. Mm-hmm. All right. So you can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com. And the channel is Tech Bites if you want to use your own IRC client. Otherwise, you can go to the website and use our client, which is Java-based and ever so secure.
Are you running an AV on yourself? You sound kind of like not entirely on top of the weather.
I have
a virus getting in there somehow, or
yeah, it's probably really bad allergies right now, but I've been kind of fighting something. So I'm glad. I'm hoping to get my summer cold over with before I travel. So that would be nice.
You should try Malware Bites.
I should just reinstall myself on top of myself.
Hey-o.
And so the IRC thing is happening. We've got that going on, and the phone number, which you will want later on in the show, is 713-526-5738. If you want to call in and be on the air, Groovehouse is here, and he's in an ever-so-good mood, and is so happy to talk to you. And, hey, nice haircut, by the way.
Hey, thank you.
I wanted to just say that, you know, as a person who doesn't have any of his own, I appreciate the efforts that you go through to keep yours looking, you know, fit for radio.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. Anything that we need to talk about aside from the news that's coming up? I don't think so. Barrett's motorcycles are all in good working order.
All?
Not all.
Which one's most down?
Are you over 50%?
I'm over 50%. The speed triple is still, I haven't taken that down there to figure out the cylinder issue.
I thought I could get him to buy a motorcycle. A friend of mine had a Triumph up for sale.
It was a newer, it was a Bonneville, it's pretty, but yeah. I'm at my
how limit. Can I say,
I mean, sold my car.
Everybody else who showed Barrett a motorcycle for sale and said, yes, I'll buy that motorcycle. I do it, and crickets.
Maybe he feels comfortable saying no to you because he knows you well, but people he doesn't know very well.
No, I just really don't have the room.
No, he wasn't going to give me the win, and then allow me to mock him for buying too many damn motorcycles.
You can't have it both ways, James.
Tonight's Barrett time. He's going to outline how he just kept buying motorcycles, waiting for you to offer him one,
baiting
so
Jay.
He could say no. And it's like,
no, good sir. The joke is on you.
The greatest troll ever.
I got it.
I've been boned. Now, for those of you who are listening at home who may not understand, Barrett has
a house.
I have motorcycles. Flicked has black vehicles.
He's a connoisseur.
If we're going to throw some stones.
And the problem is he always has an odd number of cylinders that work on the total collection of motorcycles.
Never the right number.
What is the per capita? How many new vehicles has Flicted bought in the last 2 years, and how many new vehicles have you bought? New to you, not necessarily brand new.
Well, I also went 20 years without having any real garage, so this is all very late.
So you
latent.
Got a garage,
I just finally
you
got a
garage.
That's
out.
The whole problem.
That didn't stop me.
Yeah.
You know what else goes in garages? Ping pong tables, workbenches, Arduino factories.
Not anymore.
So if there's, he's still working out, you know, if we get motorcycles, question mark, garage, profit. All right, so we're just proud of you. We're so happy that you have your motorcycles, and especially when they work.
It keeps me
happy.
He's
going to put them all together into one huge transformer cycle for the art car parade eventually.
He's going to actually help.
But it won't work.
Ooh, the motorcycles were the junkions. They only spoke in quotes from 80s TV shows.
Is this for real?
Yeah.
And I mean, for real in the sense that
the 80s TV quotes, I didn't realize. I didn't know that.
Well, it was because I think it was because the show was during the 80s.
I may not have been able to separate it. It may have just been, I don't know if it was bad writing.
I don't think it was all 80s quotes, but it was all, because the deal was supposedly they received audio and video reception from the Earth, and that's how they learned how to communicate. And so all of their communication was always in quotes from movies and TV shows and radio. And
Optimus Prime only got soul. He only got to listen to it. So you have that big, strong voice.
I always thought that Junkions were cool because my goal when I was in college was to go 24 hours without ever actually uttering a single sentence that was of my own construction. I never got close, but I would go for a pretty long time sometimes only quoting, you know, movies and TV shows to have conversations.
You know, that makes my whole Barrett buying motorcycles for years as a plot to be a joke sound a lot more plausible.
It all makes us relevant, yeah. And Flick, that's 100% correct on his Junkion, yeah.
Well, if history. We were some kind of, like, geek version of the Justice League or something, and there was an emergency, we'd all go to Barrett's garage and get our own motorcycle and go off and save the day.
But I've got my own motorcycles.
Fine.
I need Barrett's
you need to store yours in the collective. Barrett says, what do you mean? Use my motorcycles. For your own damn motorcycles.
I can't ride them all. We're going to have to do a small army.
I only got enough for me. All right. So the phone number a little bit later on, you're going to want it 713-526-5738 to be on the air with Technology Bites. But in the meantime, we're going to go to San Antonio. All right. We're going to listen
back,
and then realize that Pete's right here and do the Technology Bites.
I'm not finding Pete on Skype, so I'm not sure how this is going to go.
It's the sound of the Skype hanging up on him.
Oh, is that what that was?
I tried.
Either that or it's from Lost in Space.
My parrot can make complex electronic noises. He has no lips, and I can't make it. All right, so take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Love that potting down for the while the intro plays. It's just like being at home. I can get that last throat clear in. Interesting news. New report from the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, says consumers aren't always getting the broadband speeds that internet service providers are advertising. That's from the Department of the Obvious Department. If you're a DSL customer, it's a very bad thing. But if you get your internet another way, you might actually be happy about it. Digital subscriber line or DSL customers are actually getting download speeds that are only 91% of the speeds they pay for during peak hours, the FCC says, while cable, fiber, and satellite customers are getting speeds that are actually faster than advertised. See, apparently, that group went to the school of business where the number means at least, where DSL apparently means under ideal conditions, then maybe, which is just pretty pathetic, especially given that the DSL stuff in the early days of the internet, one of the downsides of cable was you were kind of sharing bandwidth with everybody in your kind of zone. And DSL, you know, you had your dedicated connection back to the central office, where apparently they've taken advantage of that to not give you what you're supposed to get. So pretty sad. Cable customers' speeds were 102% of advertised. Fiber were 113% of the advertised speed. And satellite connections were a whopping 138% of the advertised speed. I don't think that's a factor of the satellite connections being faster, but more that they didn't add over promise what they deliver. The numbers come from surveys conducted for the agency's annual Measuring Broadband America report. DSL customers may have slower connections because speed depends on the length of the copper wire that connects the customer's house to the provider terminal. So I guess it's the downside of that direct connection to the central office. Actual connection speeds are just over the advertised speeds 97% of the time on average, the FCC says, but, quote, consumers deserve to get what they pay for, said Chairman Tom Wheeler in a statement. While it's encouraging to see in these in the past, these reports have encouraged providers to improve their services. I'm concerned that some providers are failing to deliver consistent speeds to customers that are commensurate to their advertised speeds. The agency will be sending sternly worded warning letters to CEOs of companies that do not deliver on advertised speeds, he said. Or, let me guess now, they're going to say they'll just lower the speed they advertise. That'd be my guess for a lot of these places, that rather than actually fix the problem, they'll just lower the promise. Which actually, somebody online had a very good point, which is all these companies are buying each other, like AT&T buying DirecTV and Comcast buying Time Warner Cable and all that. The money they're spending to do that, how much broadband could you buy for the entire country? How much could you build out for the entire country for the billions? And it's way more than the cost of upgrading the backbone and giving higher speeds to pretty much everybody for less money. But instead, they have the cash to buy to lower competition. Because if you think about it, Comcast buying Time Warner and AT&T buying DirecTV means that we will go from like six providers of cable, internet, etc., our TV programming, etc., down to four. That, by any measure I've ever seen, that's less competition. That's dividing up the same market with a smaller number of players. In other news, more than 50% of surveyed teens send sexual texts to each other, and 28% of those are photos, according to a new study from Drexel University. Quote, under most existing laws, if our findings were extrapolated nationally, several million teens could be prosecuted for child pornography. Isn't that nice? Explained a 2012 study on the rise of sexting among minors. You kids just have it so easy nowadays. back in our day, to get a girl to even talk to you, you just had to imagine them without clothes. Sorry. Anyways, despite adults' attempts over the last 2 years, teens have not suppressed their inner demons in favor of legal prudence. Many teens could be held liable for texts they sent as a minor or between their friends of different ages. Some of this, I think, shows that it's kind of bizarre that you could be prosecuted for child pornography of a picture of yourself. Because that's what you're talking about. You sext a picture to somebody, then the deal is, it's a picture of somebody underage. So, does that mean that the person who took the picture should be, that some, 14-year-old kid should be prosecuted as producing child pornography? And it's like, geez, what's next? Oh, sorry, kids. It starts sounding Victorian, Don't look in the mirror, kids. The NSA will come and get you for child pornography. So, I must say, just as a, father in person who's old enough to know better, it's probably not a great idea, kids. For all our younger listeners out there, we're all hip and cool to the your sexting and all that stuff, but it's probably not a great idea. Putting anything on the internet, and we've said this one for almost 20 years now, once it gets on the internet, you kind of don't have control over it like you would expect anymore, or once you start putting it out there electronically. So maybe think about that one before you send that picture or write up that interesting text. Anyways, here's an interesting one. Google is well known for building their own server hardware because of their unique needs on their massive computer network, but that won't always be the case, according to the head of its infrastructure team. As cloud deployments get bigger and more widespread, the industry will eventually catch up to Google's style of computing, and the company thinks it will no longer need to build its own systems. That's according to Urs Holtzley. I'm sure I'm butchering that one, but the executive in charge of Google's technical infrastructure in an onstage interview at the GigaOm Structure Conference Wednesday. Google initially built its own servers just to save money, he said. It hasn't been short of money for a long time, obviously, but still, it still designs its own servers today. basically because it thinks about data centers more holistically than most other companies and designs its servers to work in tandem with the power and cooling equipment to minimize energy costs. I wonder how similar whatever they're doing is to the Machine from HP, if you've heard that news story. Which we ought to, since HP is in town, we probably should figure out how to Shanghai somebody from there who can, like, give us more insight on the on it. Google basically, though, treats the data center as a computer rather than the single box as the computer, and he said that really pushes you in a different direction, which I guess is true. You wonder why they can't, like, put all the power supplies, like, in one corner and wire them up from there, but... Anyways, I'm sure if it was smart, they'd have already tried it and figured out if it worked. And now, and you know, from sending stuff that you shouldn't to sending texts that you shouldn't and pictures that you shouldn't to an app that I think you shouldn't, but go ahead if you want. In certain web-obsessed circles, the word of the day today was definitely yo. Yo is a ridiculously simple smartphone app that allows you to contact friends with one-word messages that say, you guessed it, yo. That's it. The app launched on April 1st, and that's not a joke, but only really started to pick up viral steam recently, culminating in full-on fad status today after a feature in the Financial Times, which noted, and here's the most absurd part of the entire story, Yo has received $1 million in funding from high-profile investors. Hey, investors, I've got my new app. It's called WTF. And what it does is every time you invest in something that has no prospect of making money other than while it's a fad, and if you invest in it when it's peaking as a fad, how do you make money off of it? Then it would send you my message, which is WTF. Anyways, according to people who have used it, it's weird fun for a few hours, but definitely a fad. In The Verge or in TechCrunch, the article says that the fascination with it feels a lot like the fascination a lot of people had for that Friday song a few years back. It's so stupidly simple you can't quite believe it actually was made and put out for public consumption. So, yeah, the guy who made it has, like, moved. He was from Israel. He's moved here to San Francisco. He is hiring people with his $1 million. And I don't know what he's going to do, add a letter every few months to maybe, like, get the hype back up? So, you know, the question, are we in a tech bubble again? This could be put in the column of maybe. Finally, a new product that actually, you know, that will be interesting to watch at least. You know, we mentioned that Amazon had a big event coming up, and they announced... it got leaked out ahead of time, but they announced a phone, a cell phone. It's the Amazon Fire Phone. It's got a 4.7-inch display and unlimited photo storage. So they had their big event today. It's the first smartphone from Amazon. The Fire Phone joins the growing stable of hardware, including the Kindle and Fire HDX and those stuff, with this device offering a 4.7-inch IPS LCD display with 590 nits of brightness. That is so useless. Dynamic image contrast and a circular polarizer. Wow, you know that sounds like somebody from Star Trek wrote that. You know, as said by Thomas Jefferson and Pollux 4 of Beta 7. Encased in a rubber frame with aluminum buttons and Gorilla Glass 3 on the front. It's got a Snapdragon processor with 2 gigs of RAM. It has a GPU. On the back is a 13-megapixel camera with flash. There's something that people would know what it was. Optical image stabilization. It's got a dedicated button on the side for taking photographs, with Fire Phone owners benefiting from free unlimited photo storage on Amazon Cloud Drive. It's got stereo speakers in it, plus with Dolby Digital Plus. It's got headphones with a tangle-free design. Well, that's a nice little feature. Now how much would you pay? And magnetic earbuds. The big thing is that they're big, you know, wow, this is the big headline thing for it, is that they have a 3D interface on their smartphone called Dynamic Perspective. You can fill in the echo thing in post. So it uses a collection of 4 extra cameras on the front so that it can tell the depth it can tell how far away it is from your face. So it senses the, it gives a sense of depth to the lock screen and apps with perspective changing in relation to the user's face. Or for any of you kids who used to get Cracker Jacks, it's like those little cards that when you turned them, the picture like flipped between two perspectives or changed. Let's see. One example app used tilting to trigger the zooming of a product image, with side tilting allowing the app to cycle through all the available images. Now that's actually useful. Dynamic perspective will also be available for app developers to use in their apps, so Amazon isn't bogarting the cool tech. The main navigation of the Fire Phone uses the carousel seen elsewhere on Amazon's Fire OS devices with a few changes. Scrolling through the carousel now brings up a preview of items within the app, like a list of recent emails, he said clearly. There's a more typical Android app grid that you can also select. Just like the Kindle Fire, the Fire Phone will work with all of Amazon's online services. Order now. Access to Prime Music and Prime Video are included, as well as reading Kindle books with Amazon's Immersion Reading, Kindle Newsstand, and Comixology. The Mayday support feature, that's the one where you push the button and the helper person comes on your phone, is included, so you get 24/7 support at no extra charge. So you don't have to call into radio shows to get help with your Kindle, with your Fire Phone. And there's an app called Firefly that's the other big thing. I think the biggest things from the Amazon phone are the 3D interface and the Firefly. It's a feature that allows for product recognition using the rear camera or the microphone. And basically, it the obvious things are you take a picture or you point it at a barcode or type thing and it'll pick that up. But it'll also, apparently, if you like point it at a show, If it can sometimes figure out what program that is and like connect you to the DVDs of that program or stuff like that, or music, where of course all of this is tied to connecting you to Amazon to buy whatever it is that you're looking around at or listening to or whatever. So it's got 32 gigs of storage. And it's being sold as a pre-order for $200 on a 2-year AT&T contract. And then there's a 64-gig version that's coming that will cost $300, again, with the 2-year contract. Both versions will include 12 months of free Amazon Prime, which usually costs $100. So if you were already going to get Amazon Prime, then that does sort of lower the price of the phone. The interesting thing with it is that for that price range, that puts it really directly in competition with like the iPhone 5S. So they're going right for, price-wise at least, they're going right for Apple's main area as far as what they're top of the line as opposed to a discount thing. There were rumors about maybe them giving it away for free, but I'm guessing they're going to see how much cash they can extract before that. The thing you could see where long-term I could see they might end up giving it away free just because it connects you up, give it away free with Prime, is that it connects you up to Amazon to buy your stuff. And Apple, not to be outdone, the rumor mill cranked up and said that the iPhone 6 might have a barometer. Yeah, the big one like you used to have in your den, the big round. Actually, what it is the barometer would be for tracking altitude and local weather. That sounds like, totally somebody pulled out of their back pocket. No, code in the iOS 8 and Xcode 6 beta suggests this. Updated CoreMotion APIs make explicit reference to an altitude tracking framework and check if a device supports it. I don't know. They maybe should, I guess the problem is, they want to do their actual business, but wouldn't it be nice to have the money to hire a unit that puts in, like, checks for device support for things that you just don't even imagine or plan to implement, just to jack with the people who go through all this code? And yeah, there's a framework that if it's got the teleportation device, that it'll implement it. iOS 8 also contains references to generic air pressure tracking, which could mean that future iOS devices will be able to gauge weather on their own and or support apps aimed at professionals like pilots. Sources for 9to5 Mac claim that at the least, Apple's been working on an updated version of its own Compass app that can track altitude. That feature is also said to have been considered for iOS 7, however. You can find barometers in Android devices going at least as far back as the Samsung Galaxy Nexus. In Apple's ecosystem, the technology will presumably be attached to an M8 coprocessor and hence come to any product that has that chip. So that's something for you to watch for all you barometer, all you weather fans. And in other Apple news, there had been rumors that there were cheaper iMacs coming with like new specs and stuff. And I must say this one's sort of odd. What they did is they put a lower performing setup together of an iMac and lowered the price. So it's about $1,100 entry level model. It's a 21.5-inch screen. It's basically most of the same features as the 21.5-inch model from last year. Unibody aluminum enclosure, 1080p screen. The ports are the same. 8 gigs of RAM included. But it goes backwards with CPU and GPU speed. So the $1,300 model, the previous base model, had a quad-core 2.7 gigahertz Core i5 in it and Intel's best integrated GPU, the Iris. The cheaper model comes with a dual-core 1.4 gigahertz Core i5 and Intel's third best integrated GPU. Oddly enough, this is the exact same processor setup included in the speed-bumped MacBook Airs that Apple introduced in April. So essentially, you could think of this as a, I don't know, desktop MacBook Air. I guess the thing to me, I mean, it's sort of a the cheaper cut down iMac thing that may be for schools or something. They've done it in the past, but not offered it to the public, where this time it is open to the public. It still seems to be an odd choice. It's not like when they lowered the price on the MacBook Airs, that was like a competitive, you could see it as a competitive move. They really, that changes the dynamic in the marketplace. This, I don't know. It just seems kind of odd. For most people, unless you just really, really want a Mac that bad and this is the peak of your budget, I would say you probably want to treat the prior entry-level model as the start. One of the other big things is you can't upgrade the memory on this one ever at all. The memory is soldered in just like on a MacBook Air, so keep that in mind if you were going to rush out to the store to get the cheapo, relatively speaking, cheapo new iMac. You know, you basically don't get nearly the options. You can't put like a Fusion Drive in and that kind of stuff, I don't think. So if you just, you know, for your office, I guess the other way to think of this is it's a Mac Mini with a screen already there. Although I believe the Mac Mini has more horsepower than this particular iMac. And in other stuff, last couple new things, Sharp. This one's kind of cool. They've announced a new screen technology. A lot of places like Engadget says, you know, when Motorola unveiled its snappy Moto 360 smartwatch, the first thing we thought was, how do you make a round display? Sharp has one answer with its new IGZO-based freeform LCD prototype that can be sculpted into any shape. The company's current IGZOTech only works with rectangular displays where the circuits that drive the LCD live on the perimeter of the screen. Sharp managed to bake those chips into the display itself, allowing for not only a shrunken bezel but nearly any display format you might want. That'll let designers create much more compact car dashboards, new digital signage, unusually shaped monitors, and yes, of course, wearables like smartwatches. That likely won't include the Moto 360, though, since it's rumored to have an OLED display. Also, Sharp says that the freeform display is nearly ready for mass production, but not quite there yet. And finally, before I knew that Barrett wasn't buying any more motorcycles. No, I included this one just because it's interesting. The sound of a Harley Davidson roaring down your street is unmistakable, but they may be going a bit quieter with their next model. Harley Davidson posted a teaser video with a bike briefly zooming down a section of Route 66, and while you don't get a clear look at the ride in question, it doesn't sound like a Harley. They said it doesn't have the typical rolling thunder synonymous with the American motorcycles, but instead sounds like a jet engine taking off as it screams past the camera. So there could actually be an electric engine hog. Whether it'll best the Lightning LS218 on the quarter mile remains to be seen. However, any other speculation should be cleared up relatively soon, as the video is simply titled 6.19.14, 6.19.14, and wouldn't you know it, that's tomorrow. So I guess we'll know if you're going to have to get an extra battery charger for your garage. Or something like that, or wonder how you really match up Harley Davidson's kind of iconic look and sound with the silence of an electric. I guess they could put big speakers on it. You could put big speakers on it and have recordings of various classic Harleys that you could select. That might work. That would be the lamest.
They could just let the actual person who bought the motorcycle record themselves going potato, 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 potato.
Oh, they could give them a Mr. Microphone and they could do whatever they like with it. You know,
I think I read somewhere in California, this is my mic up, in California I read that they've got a lot of, you know, electric bikes, and I think there's legislation saying that bikes made 2015 or 2016 on have to have some sort of electric noisemaker to let people know that they're approaching, like some sort of beeping or something at a certain amount of decibels when they hit a certain speed.
Yeah, they've had there was talk about that
waka waka
for electric cars.
Waka 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 waka.
I guess
waka.
For the blind or the handicapped.
You know, people just don't. It's really eerie. I rode an electric bike maybe a few months ago, and you hear nothing but the wind. I mean, it's completely silent. Like, you would scare birds, you would scare, you know, dogs. It's just completely silent. It's an odd experience because you really do associate it with all the noise.
But there could be a whole business in that, though, you know, with the various sounds. You could have the Model T sound. You could have.
They're like ringtones. I bet there's going to be, an autotone, you know?
I'm totally Pac-Man.
And that's the news.
All right.
Thanks for that, Peter.
So are you going to just do 80s quotes the rest of the night?
Can you do it? Can you pull off nothing but 80s quotes?
What's up?
He's out of practice.
All right, 713-526-5738 is the number to call if you'd like to be on the air with us tonight. We're all here in the studio, standing by, ready to take your calls, questions, concerns, comments, or whatever about technology.
I like the idea that Flicted is so original, he has to try really hard not to be original. That's how hard it is not to utter words that have ever been uttered before.
It just about silences him to ask him to not to try and speak only.
All right, just I'll tell you what. Here's the challenge for Flicted tonight. He needs to respond to everything using a quote or sound effect from an arcade game. I mean, the best you can, like, you know, the joust shriek or whatever. So nice. He's got that working in his brain now. All right, 713-526-5738. You know, I've come to terms with the fact that we have to give out the number a lot during fundraiser, you know, to get you to call in. But this whole new thing of, you know, working so hard to get calls to be on the air, that's
nobody's even
changed.
Calling in about the whole teenage sexting thing or any of that. Jeez. You just think that something.
You think child pornography would have got angered up.
What does
blood?
It take to get to you people?
Lord. All right. So, yeah. So, I saw that Lee from Ars Technica said, I have seen the future and it is Yo. And he sent a screenshot of the Yo app.
I mean, it's one thing when you hear about some app and you go, you know, oh, geez, that sounds lame. And then you hear the rest of what it does, the other thing. But it doesn't sound to me like Yo does anything other than
Yo.
I mean, and you kind of go, the thing I think about is we've already been through the WhatsApp time frame.
But there was no venture capital in WhatsApp, was there? I mean, it was just the beer. So there was, you know, there was that. There was really venture capital.
The flow of money was the other way for that. Yeah, there was all paid advertising.
It was paid advertising, which generated awareness of their product, which caused them to sell more product. Apparently, companies like that anyway are so, they make so much money that they advertising on such a scale is beneficial to them as a tax concern.
Well, the thing with Yo is that it seems to have taken, like, the thing you mentioned earlier, which is the, you know, make app, profit.
Right.
Except the problem was, it used to be that the profit part never happened because obviously they hadn't figured out step two. Apparently he's just jumped right over step two to at least investment.
Well,
maybe that's step two.
If you think about it, Yo is really just Twitter distilled down to the two most essential characters. It's gone from 140 characters to two characters.
No, I think the most important two characters on Twitter are M-E. Me! Look at me! Look at my food! Look at me! It's all look at me is really Twitter.
Well, I would say
as opposed to Yo.
I think Yo is still look at me. It's because it's Yo is the poke of the just.
I think
the
they
texting.
Made a mistake. They left a lot of room at the bottom of the market. Like, haven't you watched Price is Right? Someone's going to bid a dollar. Someone's going to go one character, and it's going to put you out of business.
What about 6 minute abs?
Just oh.
What? No, 6 minutes. If well, you've watched, there's something about Mary lately. It's been on.
Jake, can you throw the link in IRC to the Lee Hutchins thing? I'm not having any luck on Google finding it. I have seen the future, and
it's
is
a tweet.
It's a tweet. Oh, that's why I can't find it. Never mind.
Hang on, I'll get
if it's just a tweet, that pretty much
it's a tweet with
I'm
a
sure.
screenshot. Here
okay,
it is.
I want to see it.
Let me see. So, let me bring up the in the Twitter client. I guess I have to bring up his webpage and then.
See, it changes how kids. It changes everything. Now, in the future, instead of being embarrassed by your, you know, mullet or your poor 80s or 70s, depending on your age, clothing choices or parents' clothing choices, now you'll be embarrassed when your kids find your old phone, your old smartphone, and power it up and go, "What's this Yo thing?" And. Who's Sarah?
What is this?
There's a picture
of.
I'm not sure I understand how to operate the pornography machine. All right.
That'll be the talk you're having with your kid. There's a point in your life when you start taking pictures, and then you get a little bit older, and you should stop. No, anyways.
Okay, Yo is silly. I just saw the screenshot. I hoped it would be more. But no.
it's all you expected and less.
Yeah, and less.
All right, see that we have some calls coming in, so hooray for that. 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Hello, Groovehouse.
Hello, Jay.
Who do we have?
Up first on the show, we are going to speak with Matthew.
Matthew, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I just got this Android. I've been an iPhone man for the last 5 or 4 years, and I just got this Android. And they got this thing on it called Google Drive or whatever. Google Play. Yeah, Google Play.
Google Play, and which is the app store for Android.
Okay. Is there any kind of way I could disable that?
What do you mean disable it?
Well, it just keeps telling me, it sending me messages that I'm near a Wi-Fi connection and they need to download a new application. Or some kind of update, but they need to connect to a Wi-Fi.
Okay,
My first question is, why would you need to have a Wi-Fi on a cell phone? I pay $30 a month for internet service.
Well, some of the apps, they want to update over Wi-Fi because they use so much data. There's so much data coming down that it's faster and more efficient, doesn't chew up your data plan.
Also, if they didn't do that, then you would suddenly get your bill that said that you went way over on your data.
Well,
in the old days, you went way over on your data, and here's your massive
bill. Now, you could
bill.
Turn these notifications off.
Or even, do you have a data plan with your phone, or do you just have phone service?
I have unlimited data. I'm grandfathered in from a long time ago.
If you've got unlimited data and if you've got a new Android phone, the two things you can do to get rid of that is you can go into the settings, and the first thing you can do is you can enable background data or just enable mobile data.
Uh-huh.
I think that may be what's happening with some of these apps because most of them should update over the air. You don't have to have Wi-Fi for everything. Then the other thing you can do is you can actually go into the Play Store and you can tell all of your apps to auto-update. So they'll just do it when you're not paying attention. The only time they'll throw a notification is if some application needs more permissions than it used to and it just wants you to sign off on that. For instance, like you might have something that just used to be able to use the network connection and now it wants to monitor your phone calls and look at this. It'll say, hey, this application wants to do this. Yes or no. You tell it yes and then you don't have to touch touched again until it makes some other change. But that way they happen in the background. You do want to keep your apps updated.
Yeah, for simplicity's sake, there should be an option there to let you enable automatic updates so it's just not annoying you all the time. Although if license agreements change and so forth, you will be asked to acknowledge those. But it's a good idea to keep your apps up to date. It's a good idea to keep your phone's operating system up to date. So any patches or security updates that might come across for that. So as Barrett mentioned, you can enable that to where it will do it over your over the cellular broadband if you like. But they want you to go through a couple of steps and make sure you know that that's what you want to do, because not everybody has an unlimited data plan.
Yeah.
And so some people get a surprise if they find out that they've got 1 million apps installed and they got 500,000 updates and suddenly they've gone over their quota and they get a bill for that. They don't like that. So that's why that does that. But dig into the phone a little bit. I know on the iPhone it's easy to set up where you just tell it to do it in the background. And it doesn't ever bother you.
Yeah, and that's for anybody else listening. You know, put on the automatic updates unless you're afraid you're going to, you know, don't, or turn them off before you go to Europe.
Yeah, if you leave the country, if you do some things like that.
Data where it can be very expensive. But otherwise, you want those to update. Mm-hmm. I have seen so many, you know, when I'm supporting somebody at an office that's got an iPad, the thing that always gets to me is, you know, so you hit the key and you see the main screen and it shows the app store and it shows how many apps they need to update. And I think the record was one that I saw today, which was 79. So this guy has never updated an app on this machine, on this iPad ever. And that's not a good idea. That's 79 security holes sitting there, possibly waiting to be exploited on.
So if you're having trouble finding any of these settings, it's pretty easy to get online and Google, you know, automatic updates on Android phone, or put in your model of phone and so forth. And I know that when you first get them, it kind of, I know my friend Jim just bought his first cell phone, and it's an Android. It's one of the less expensive ones, and it had a bunch of updates that it had to do just because it had an outdated version of Gmail. Even it had a number of things that were out of date and that needed to be updated, and it's making all kinds of noises and stuff. So he's got to kind of, whenever you get a new device, especially if it's a platform you're not familiar with, you kind of have to tame it. You have to know. Yeah. You have to know what.
Let me ask you this now. The thing about the apps is about 90% of them I have no use for. I don't even know what the hell they are.
Uninstall them.
Well, if the thing about a lot of the less expensive Android phones is they come with the built-in apps that can't be removed.
Mm. Okay, is the 4S active inexpensive?
The 4S? It's, yeah. No, that's a good one. But it still might have some built-in or apps from the carrier. Who's your carrier?
AT&T.
I know AT&T is pretty notorious, like Verizon is, about putting and T-Mobile about putting apps that are built in.
Yeah.
But you can go through the apps that you have, and if you don't want them, you can uninstall them if you care to. I know they sometimes throw a lot of apps on the phone just to give you an idea of what's available out there, and they get a kickback from the app manufacturer to put those on there. Just like, it's just junkware or bloatware like you would find on a new computer.
I don't think on Apple phones.
It's
I don't
not an Apple
think,
phone, it's an Android.
Right, but on I guess we were talking about 4S.
Oh.
Made me think Apple.
Oh, it's a Galaxy.
Galaxy. Wow, that's great how they all name each other's phones the same.
Now let me ask you one more question.
Sure.
How many megapixels does this camera have?
I don't know. You didn't tell me what. You did. Yeah. You told us the 4S, right. Do you not have the documents for this thing?
Well, I haven't read it. You know, after you. Why should he be me to call you?
I don't know.
13 megapixels. 13 megapixels. So says Google.
Hey.
So it's as good as it's as good as the new Amazon phones.
All right, well, thanks for your call, and have a good evening. All right, 713-526-5738. Looking at Flicted, I'm just waiting to see if he's going to chime in with anything. But probably nothing.
Game over, man.
Peace winning.
Hey.
Now isn't that 70s?
Yeah.
That's kind of 70s, fail. Maybe 60s.
Late 70s, probably. Fail. Let's see.
Fail. That's 90s. Or that's All right, Groove House.
Yes.
Who do we have up next?
Up next, we're going to speak with Dean.
Dean, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Hi there. Yeah, I need some help. I'm running Windows 8. This morning I was having trouble with web pages loading. I tried to open up some PDF files, and there was an old PDF, one I wasn't even looking for, that showed up, would not go away no matter how many times I tried to load it, rebooted, tried, you know, everything I could think of. And so I said, well, I'm just going to restore this to a prior setting. And ran the restore, and it came up with a black screen. I got nothing. And just wondering what I can do.
So you use System Restore?
Yep.
And when it rebooted, it came up to a black screen and nothing else?
Nothing else. It loads the Dell logo, and then it goes to a gray or black, and it doesn't do anything.
So it doesn't even start to load Windows or any of that?
Nothing. Nope.
Does it make any beeps or do anything like that?
In the beginning, there is a little noise up until the point the Dell logo shows up, and then it's, as I say, it goes to black, but it, you know, it's a lighter gray, kind of a, not even a real gray. It's like a.
How old is the computer?
About two and a half years.
What operating system? 7, you say?
No, 8.
8. Okay. Well, my concern is that if you had something going on where things weren't working properly, obviously using System Restore to try to go back to a previous state it's a recommended option by Microsoft for kind of clearing up issues. However, if the issue was hardware, then like a problem with memory or a problem with the hard drive or something like that, when you went into System Restore, it may have pulled into some corrupt data, or it may have corrupted data, or it may have just caused you may have just been in the process of the hard drive failing or something like that. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
But you have a computer that won't give you a Windows splash screen or anything like that. It's not even getting to the operating system. That's kind of alarming in the sense that it could be indicating that you have hardware failure going on. Have you had a computer before Windows 8, like with XP or Windows 7 or anything like that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I've been through, you know, Windows 3.1 all the way.
All right, so you're familiar with safe mode and Windows 90, Windows XP and all of that?
Right, but I tried to find a safe mode mechanism. It was F10, F12, none of that would actually get me.
F8 typically is what will cause it to try to load or go into a selective startup or into a safe mode startup. But if it's not getting to the point where it's actually loading the operating system, then you're not going to be able to get into safe mode either.
Yeah. Well, what I've done at this point, I've got the hard drive out. I'm going to move it to another computer because I got shows to build. But I one other question. I use Thunderbird, right, for my email.
Yeah.
How am I going to find those files? Because I desperately need them.
Well, you're going to get on a computer that's connected to the internet, and you're going to look for archive or copy Thunderbird email archives. I don't know exactly where Thunderbird stores it, but it'll be in a drive. It'll be in a folder on your hard drive, and there are probably at least 600 or 700 web pages that talk about how to access the email archive for Thunderbird. So if you get the drive connected to another computer, you're going to browse in Windows 8. It's likely going to be under C:\users\ whatever your login name is. And then it's either going to be under app data, or it might be under program data. It's something related to Thunderbird where it keeps all of the mail store.
Do you know the extension of that file?
I haven't used Thunderbird in a long time, and I have actually, honestly, have never backed up the email from Thunderbird. But it may be, you know, if it's like Eudora was, it could be individual files for each mailbox, so an inbox file, a sent items file, and so forth. So it might be a folder with a collection of files. Let me see if I can. Find that real quick.
Thunderbird. I'm trying to remember if Thunderbird uses Mbox or.
Yeah, let's see. Moving your mail storage location. By default, your mail is stored in your profile folder along with address books and settings. If you want to move your mail but not the entire contents, blah, blah, blah. Thunderbird tries to check. Do you have another computer that's online?
Well, I've got one that I'm setting up today and this evening.
All right, well, the reason I'm asking you this is like if I was to go through and find the answer and tell you where the mail store is, are you going to be able to remember it? Or is it going to be more beneficial to you if you go and just do, if you go to Mozilla's website, or if you just go to Google and search location of mail store or Thunderbird mail, you'll find information that tells you how to go and find it. Like what I would do is I would just do a search on backup Thunderbird mail. You will find, you know, a website that talks about how to go get that mail and how to move it to a new computer.
Okay. I will do that. I appreciate the advice. And insofar as the one that died, once I get the files transferred, I think I'll just try to rebuild it, I guess.
Well, do you have your Windows 8 DVD, your installation DVD, or did you make, like, the System Restore DVD?
I don't, no.
Okay, if you can get a hold of one, or if you can, you get that operating system or hard drive you moved over to another machine, if you can make one, some people are reporting they're having gray screen boot loop issues. And yeah. If you go in and pop in your Windows 8 and you say, hey, I want to repair this OS, it's bringing it back. It looks like it could be just some things get mungled. A lot of people are having it when they go back to restore points. A lot of them are having it when they go from 8.0 to 8.1. But that could be an option for you, but you need that DVD.
Okay. I don't have the DVD. It came preordained.
Okay, well, when you buy a new computer, one of the things they recommend that you do, or one of the things you're asked to do, is to go through and make recovery disks that might be an operating system disk. Or who makes your computer?
It was Dell, and you're right. I did, when I was leaving the house, I found a Dell backup or restore thing. I don't know what it exactly said, but I will give it a try.
Well, the location of the Thunderbird profile information is under users, username, app data, roaming, Thunderbird profiles. So I found it pretty quick doing a Google search, so you can look under that folder system for your Thunderbird mail. But it, as Barrett was mentioning, if you can get a copy of the install disk for Windows 8 that you have, the same version, and you may contact Dell. They'll usually send you one for the cost of the media if you didn't make one when you did your backup or did your setup. But an operating system disk allows you to put that in the CD drive or the DVD drive, boot from that disk, and you'll be presented with an option to repair your install of Windows, and that would allow you to go through and have it try to fix what it's seeing there. Maybe you'll just recover the whole thing.
Well, that's certainly the hope. All right.
All right. Thanks for your call, Dean.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, there's the lovely music that tells us that we need to take a break here.
Yo.
Backups? We don't need no stinking backups.
That's not 80s either. But these are movie references, I guess, and TV references, so we just give them a broad, broad brush.
Although they said badges. That's pretty original. He's being original again.
Even when he tries to be derivative, he's original.
All right. Well, you're tuned into Technology Bites. We've got to take a short break and do some station business, but we'll be back after this stuff here. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm going to knock you out.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
KPFT transmite por el aire 24 horas del día, 7 días de la semana, y cubre diferentes tipos de gente y gente con diferentes estilos de vida. KPFT está aquí cuando usted necesita lo mejor de noticias, independientes y música durante el día. Pero manteniendo este tipo de recurso no viene barato. KPFT necesita su contribución para continuar a tener esta estación única cuando usted lo necesite. Si usted está escuchando cuando se prepara por la cama o cuando se está levantando en la mañana para el trabajo, ¿por qué no hablar a la línea de departamentos de miembros a KPFT y hacer un miembro? El número es fácil. Para recordar, es 713-526-4000, extensión 314. O puede visitarnos en nuestra página kpft.org y dar su contribución. Esto es KPFT Houston.
If you have friends in other cities who wish they had access to some of the great programming you hear on this station and the Pacifica Radio Network, we have a website for you.
PacificaNetwork.org gives community radio stations like this one complete information on how to become a Pacifica affiliate and information for listeners looking for community radio stations that air Pacifica programming.
With the launch of PacificaNetwork.org, Pacifica Radio is bringing together frequently requested items regarding Pacifica as a network.
Nearly 100 radio stations.
From Carbondale, Colorado to Benwood, West Virginia.
From Bend, Oregon to Hobbs Ferry, New York.
From Moscow, Idaho to Chicago, Illinois.
Have all made a statement by linking up and carrying Pacifica radio programming.
So tell your far-flung friends about PacificaNetwork.org to connect communities.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston.
Hey, Barrett, what's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you...
Barrett time! Barrett time! Barrett time!
Yeah. That means it's time for...
Barrett time!
Yeah. Anyway. Take it away, Barrett.
Yo. And that's it for Barrett time. All right. Tin print.
There's all investors on the phone for you.
Tin print. All right. 20. Go to 10. So if you've ever wondered past a demonstration PC in a store in the 80s, placed directly and afflicted, you may have seen the results of those two lines of code, Barbara pulling down a monochrome monitor. Any idea what language that is?
Basic.
Basic, yes. Which stands for?
Basic.
Yes. Almost. That's Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instruction Code. So developed in 1964 by John Kimony and Thomas Kurtz at Dartmouth College, New Hampshire, BASIC's original intent was to enable students not otherwise pursuing a mathematics or science degree to use a computer. At the time, it was possible to communicate instructions to a machine using a low-level language native to the architecture or, as the vast majority of computer users did, through a special purpose language designed to tackle a certain set of problems. Examples of languages developed in the 50s that did just that were COBOL, the common business-oriented language. We talked about that a few weeks ago. ALGOL, short for algorithmic language, and LISP, which uses a fully parenthesized Polish prefix notation. Fortran, derived from formula translating system, was another contemporary language of the time, and has been used for over half a century to crunch big numbers in numerical weather prediction, computational fluid dynamics, and computational chemistry. Very cool stuff for engineers, but none of these languages were particularly suited for writing a recipe manager or digital Rolodex. Not that it wasn't done, it just wasn't yet accessible to the washed masses. The 60s saw Snowball, or the string-oriented symbolic language. So does anyone see the issue with that? String-oriented and symbolic language has the acronym SOSL. So in order to poke fun at COBOL, the engineers at AT&T Bell Laboratories had to use the S and the N from string, the B-O from symbolic. I'm sure that wasn't the only B-O back in the Bell Labs those days, and the L in language. Snowball's use has tapered off since the 70s and 80s, being replaced by things like awk and Perl, which borrowed a bit from Snowball's concept of regular expressions. The biggest difference is that Snowball allowed recursiveness, which awk and Perl regular expressions do not. So if you're completely lost of or completely bored by now, you're also probably now aware of why a language like BASIC was needed. BASIC was easy to learn, contained familiar words, and while it didn't do anything particularly well, there wasn't much it couldn't do. It was truly an all-purpose language, at least in the context of microcomputers in the 1970s and 80s. So most microcomputers shipped with BASIC at the time, many machines having it loaded in their firmware, making it one of the first widely accessible programming languages to the average American. One of the first killer apps, as it were, was a text-based game that put the USS Enterprise on a mission to hunt down and destroy an invading fleet of Klingon warships. In fact, the BASIC spawned many typing computer game books, which image teams would spend hours typing in line after line of code to play a game with some text-based graphics. So this is usually where I segue into the true nugget of Barrett time knowledge, and this time it's a bit more of a reach than usual. So not a Snowball-style reach, but it's reaching all the same. I'm also recycling the This Day in History theme, which I wouldn't do if people would just stop making history. So what happened on this day that ties all this together? Any guesses? Did anyone see Google today? I don't know if they actually did anything with it. No. So on this day in 1979, with just over 200,000 copies of Microsoft Basic out for the Z80 and 8080 processors, a little over 2 million in sales, and just 28 employees, Bill Gates drops the 16-bit version of Basic for the new 8086 16-bit microprocessor, which would soon find its way into homes across the U.S. in numbers never imagined. So the new 16-bit version was built from the Altair Basic, which Bill Gates and Paul Allen had developed in 1975 under the company name Micro-S Soft. So Microsoft, a little bit different. They later dropped the hyphen and the capitalization on the S, and then promptly went on to make billions of dollars. 11 years later, in 1991, Microsoft introduced Visual Basic, taking the text-based language into the GUI age. In fact, Visual Basic had a bit of an upswing the last few years and is currently the sixth most popular language on the Tyobi Software Popularity Index for June of 2014. So while C and Java are still king and queen, Basic is beating out the likes of PHP, Python, JavaScript, Ruby, and Perl in terms of popularity. If you've been wanting to learn to bend computers to your will, one line of language at a time, Basic may be for you. But for now, that's it for this lesson in Lispy Linguistics, and that's that for Barrett time.
All right. Thanks for that, Barrett. All right, and all of our lines have gone clear. 713-526-5738, if you would like to be on the air with Technology Bites.
Yeah, I've decided to develop an app that pairs up with Yo. It's called Oi. And so when somebody sends you a Yo, you send them an Oi.
It's the Australian version.
Oi!
I just want an app maybe that just says, dang it! Flick it still. You can see the things scrolling behind the eyes.
Shazam!
Shazam!
That was 70s too, though. Yeah, that's...
even before the 70s.
It might have been late 60s. That was black and white. Gomer Pyle started out, and then they went to colors. That had to be, I guess, early 60s. Oh,
well, I thought you were talking about the actual, like, Shazam, the kids' Saturday morning show with Mentor and some horrible special
vaguely
effects.
Familiar, but yeah, I was going after the Gomer Pyle. I just didn't do the accent.
There was like some. There Jim was Neighbors like does. A set of, the what, Electra Did. Woman and Dyna Girl? They actually, there was this like, there was the whole Sid and Marty Krofft, and there was a bunch of live action crap, I think would be the word that would apply, that they put out on the Saturday mornings in the late 70s.
Also from the 70s, though, so either reference still would have been a decade too early.
And there actually was, somebody made like a pilot to reboot that, to bring that back, to Electra Woman and Dyna Girl, which was part of some program that had like four or five different crummy live-action deals with it, segments that they would rotate around and that were too lame even for kids. But anyways.
All right. Well, I see Groovehouse is screening a call for us. We have all of our other lines are open. 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air. Shazam!
Although their costumes were pretty hot for the 70s.
Oh, it's slash cheesy. I can't make up my mind. Yeah.
It's kind
no,
of,
that was what passed. Maybe I misspoke. That's what
it's
passed.
It's hot,
hot
and uncomfortable or sort of hot and uncomfortable? I don't know. 713-526-5738.
If you put some leg warmers on them and a headband, it's freaking flash dance. Get physical and flash dance, yeah. So it was just a precursor.
Superheroes of the 70s look like your everyday person of the 80s. That's that's how fashion went.
Little known secret, we were all superheroes in the 80s.
I blame Sid and Marty Krofft. All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Do you have a call for us?
Yes, we do. We've got room for more.
We do have room for more. Groovehouse is anxious.
713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with Technology Bites.
All right,
up next on the second half of the show, our first caller is going to be Gigi.
Gigi, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi. Hi. I was wondering, I'm over 50, so I'm a little bit of technology... I don't know what the word is, but is it my iPad or is it all iPads that aren't compatible with Adobe Flash Player?
It's all iOS devices.
Okay.
They do not support Flash.
Is there any alternative that I can use?
What is it that you are wanting to do with Flash?
Well, it's sometimes it's videos I want to see, usually.
If they're on YouTube, though, then you may want to look up those videos. Go to YouTube with your iPad and look them up. And then I believe YouTube adjusts and uses the HTML5 delivery so that you don't have to have Flash.
Is it video content that's being created by, like, an educational source, or is it entertainment, or what is it?
It's all sorts of videos, and I don't know if I need to update an app, but my husband thought that iPads in general just don't...
They don't support Flash. So if you go to a website that's delivering video content or any other content using Flash, it won't work on an iPad.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's just that's one of those things. But a lot of websites are upping their game and moving away from Flash and delivering content different ways. So if you can find the video, like a lot of times if you find a video on the web, you'll also find it on YouTube. So if you find a video that you really want to see and you really want to watch it on your iPad, you can search for the name of the video using YouTube, and you might find a YouTube version of it that uses HTML5 to deliver the content, which will work on your iPad.
Okay, great. And I had one other thing, not a question, a piece of advice for you guys.
Oh, advice. Okay, we love advice. Okay.
Well, since you're techie guys, I have two stock market tips for you.
Two stock market tips.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a friend that is really good at this. He's been doing it for years, and I'm about to get into it a little bit, but he said Micron is expected to go up a lot. I forget the numbers. I'm driving right now. And also SanDisk. Huh. And this guy, he's a retired engineer, and he loves technology stocks. And that's just a couple of tips for you guys.
All right. Well, appreciate it. I don't play on market very much, but thanks for that tip.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks so much.
Have a good day.
Yeah, we'll have to ask Micron about that.
Micron technology is down 0.19 or 0.59% today. It's it looks like a.
Yeah. Sounds like you're better off investing in Micron, the former co-host of the show with us.
Well, I mean, I wonder with SanDisk is storage. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if they're.
Didn't SanDisk just buy the the Waz was associated with it. There was a like flash memory. He had a high speed memory or disk company, and it was not doing super well. And then I believe SanDisk bought it. It was something Fusion IO or something like that.
I don't know. Kingston and PNY just took a hit the last week because they were doing
SanDisk to buy Fusion IO for
$1.1 billion.
Yeah, wow. Waz was involved with it. It's a their big thing. I remember them being in the InfoShot in the past because it was their product was like huge deals of SSD type drives put together to give you like large capacity and the flash transform data center. So it's like large, it's huge deal, huge memory setups of SSD type drives, and they went public or they got invested in and had a huge valuation, and then they've kind of.
I was driving through Houston and I tuned into this really great stock show.
Buy now. I just
want to dump all of my money into the SanDisk stock based on a phone call out of the, it's quite possible they could do something. It looks like their stock's kind of steady right now, unless there's like some knowledge that they're about to do something or buy something.
Nowadays you don't have the deal like literally there was the thing where something would go public during the life of this show, in the .com boom.
Yeah.
Where there actually were people who invested because of things they'd heard us talking about, and they had huge rewards. Of course, you know what? Nobody's going to call us up and go, I've invested in that thing you guys were talking about the other day, and I lost every penny.
We are not recommending you invest in any stocks whatsoever. Whatever market games you want to play, you do that at your own risk.
We recommend you invest in KPFT during our fund drives, there during our episodes.
The return on your investment is love.
And all you right. never, you well, you always lose all the money, but you do get a mug.
Or a t-shirt.
And the entertainment.
All right. Kingston and PNY got caught shipping out, do you hear about the solid state drives?
No.
To reviewers, and then with, you know, with one configuration with very nice memory, with very nice components, with very nice everything. And then the second they get reviewed, they would switch to production and start putting in lower grade components. They all got busted on it just a few days ago.
I'm glad they got caught. Yeah. I mean, that shows something's working when they get caught. Because, I mean, the opposite was, remember back in the day, Apple was, they had found some machines that, like, the, you know, the stars aligned, and some of the machines that were coming off the line were like radically better than other machines, and they were considering like pulling those out and marketing them separately, you know, where you'd pay a little extra and you'd get the like primo machine. But doing the opposite, where you take and you take the ones that work better and give them to reviewers and then give the dogs to the public, was pretty pathetic.
Well, some of the phone makers got called out or busted for the same thing, sending out review copies of phones that had better specs than what you could what actually got when you bought it.
Yeah, these guys were actually swapping out synchronous NANDs for asynchronous NANDs. So you're talking about like half a performance cut, really, because one of them, it's like it's transmitting data on the upswing and the downswing of the clock cycle. The other one only transmits data once per clock cycle, so I think that'd only be half as fast. I mean, I'm sure the numbers don't quite work out like that, but it's pretty shady.
Still not the,
yeah.
And I'm sure that the one is more expensive than the other.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Jeez. All right, 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who do we have?
Up next, we're going to speak with Mike.
Mike, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi Jay, it's Mike.
Hi Mike.
I am I'm taking a trip next month, and I'm going over to Iceland. And traveling overseas, I need to know what's the best, what you guys would suggest for a mobile handset where I can buy one of those pay as you go kind of things.
Are you kidding about going to Iceland next month?
No, it's summer. It's pretty.
Huh?
It's summertime there. It's pretty.
Okay, where are you going?
We're just going to drive. We've got a route set up all the way around the coast. We're going to start down at the south and go all the way around the entire thing.
Have you been reading have you been reading my Facebook? Are you mocking me?
Damn it. It's Ralph. Hi, Jay.
Hello, Ralph. Yeah. I had a feeling.
Damn it.
Your parrot's really good. They're not stealing.
Huh?
I was telling my wife to shush. She was busting me.
Tell your wife to shut up.
No, but it's a serious question. And you guys haven't touched on it in a while, and this is something, you know, I'm very familiar with, traveling overseas and mobile.
I would also like to point out that Ralph, not only is he familiar with traveling overseas and using a cell phone abroad, he's also skilled at losing it while traveling abroad and then recovering it once he gets back. Apparently, if his stories are to be, remember Ralph was.
Is this the guy you saw the Roger Waters show with in Dublin? Yeah.
If the gendarme is to be believed,
if you can trust anything that comes out of his mouth, because I've been asked on a number of occasions by several people that hold very lofty positions in the tech field, is Ralph for real?
Yes.
So the journey is.
He actually lives in the ether and doesn't exist.
Here's what's really cool about. One of the things, I was getting kind of excited that I was going to, who is this going to Iceland? And yeah, but the separate from other places, now there's two schools of thought now, because you mentioned Iceland specifically, which I'm going to Iceland. You can actually buy a SIM card for the local telco on Iceland Air. So that you can have a phone that's on the local plan and with a local Icelandic number when you land. You don't have to go find a shop or anything, but if you're traveling abroad and you have an unlocked phone, go to the nearest mobile provider, whether it's Vodafone. Find out who the mobile provider is. And all over Europe, it tends to be companies like Vodafone.
O2, T-Mobile.
O2, yeah. T-Mobile, mm-hmm. Three wireless companies like that. And you can walk into any of their storefronts, and that's all they do is they deal with tourists who want to use their phones. And they're, for data, and you walk in and they'll sell you a SIM card and they'll provision it for a certain amount of data and with a local phone number, and they'll install it in your phone and send you on your way, and it works.
And right, not, and that's honestly what I was calling, because you guys haven't, you know, I listen to you almost every week, and something you haven't spoke about in a while is outside the United States, not only can you get that, but you can, your device can also operate as a GPS, a map, a finder for you, and you're not tied down to the same type of silly contracts that we are here. And it's something that I think a lot of people are not aware of, and so they spend a lot of their time looking at old-fashioned trees in a book trying to get where they're going.
Well, I think that there's still some intimidation on that, because there's a number of, you know, there's a number of steps you have to go through. So you start talking to people about unlocked devices. Well, what does that mean? So
Right, no one knows what that means.
People with smartphones swapping out the SIM
right.
card is
well,
not an intuitive thing.
Right, even then. So you have a phone, it's tied to your carrier. If you put the SIM card in from another carrier, so like if you have a, let's just stay local for a minute. You have a Verizon iPhone. And you have an, and you suddenly want to switch over to AT&T, you have to put an AT&T SIM card in your phone. If that phone is locked to Verizon, that AT&T SIM card's not going to work.
Well, plus you get into the whole.
You've got your radio turned down,
Ralph? CDMA, and
I do.
Okay.
You get the whole CDMA, the technology.
And then you have to know whether or not the phone is capable of working as a world phone or working overseas with one of those SIM cards. I've still have to research it once in a while just to go and look. But the good news is that most of the new phones now are world phones. They're tri-band or quad-band phones, so they'll work on any of the networks. So if you take a Verizon phone over to Europe, you can get a SIM card, put it in there, and use it on the local plan, no problem. But it's still rather convoluted. You have to, first of all, you have to take your SIM card out and have another SIM put in, so you have to keep track of that. But it is certainly a lot less expensive, because if you go overseas and you buy a local SIM card, it's usually about 20 or 30 bucks to buy the SIM card, and then maybe about another 20 or 30 bucks for a modicum of data on there that will suffice in minutes on the phone while you're traveling.
If you're going longer term, you may want to consider doing the adding an international plan to your subscription, and then cancel, you know, then put it back to the normal plan when you get back.
But if you look at the rates on the international plans, they're no good.
Oh, really? They're
rapey.
High. Oh,
no, it's date rape. It's
$4 a minute or some ridiculous thing.
It's ridiculous. Per, you know, the roaming. That's one of the sad things is that, you know, the roaming plans that we have, and I think they're probably the same coming back. What's sad is, like, for example, you would think T-Mobile. I could go overseas and use T-Mobile, but they're not the same company. They just completely, they don't even look at each other. So you have all these incredible roaming charges come back. Even if you enable international dialing, international data plan while you're traveling, you're still talking about 50 cents a megabyte or something like that.
Yeah, my wife went to South Africa recently, and she came back and she accidentally had the international roaming turned on, and I think there were four text messages sent, for which I got charged $32 total.
Yeah.
I think not enough people travel to where you don't have the masses screaming, hey, this is unfair, this is unfair. And then, you know, a lot of the people that are traveling, they have deep pockets enough just to be able to pay it off and kind of make it go away, so no one's really forcing them to do it. But it is a little bit ridiculous right now.
The two-step plan for the novice would be to, first of all, just make sure you have a phone that's capable of working overseas, and then make sure that it's unlocked. Verizon, I know for their iPhones are unlocked. They're not carrier specific, so you can put a foreign SIM in it, no problem. The second thing is that once you get overseas, if you're staying in a major tourist area or a major city, you go to the city center, and there's usually like a row of shops, and then there's like, you know, phone store after phone store. You go find a Vodafone store, you go find a Three Wireless store, and you walk in there, and you might have to wait a little bit, but you find yourself a salesperson there who speaks English, or if you speak their language, more power to you, and they will recommend some packages, and they'll say, okay, here's a SIM card, and here's, you know, a local phone number, it costs this much money, and then they'll walk you through, they'll install it, and they'll get it all going. The scariest thing is, I've been to a few places overseas when you're trying to get your phone set up, and they will they will put the card in your phone and they will say, look, it will be active in about 2 hours, or it might take them, you know, two or more hours or an hour or more to get before it actually comes online. So then you're kind of left kind of hovering around, making sure you can go back to the shop to make, you know, if it doesn't work, to make sure that they've got it set up right. But for the most part, I've been able to run around and Instagram just everything and have, you know, good data and only be out, you know, less than $100. Whereas if I tried to do that on a roaming plan, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of dollars to be able to do that, maybe thousands.
Jeez.
So good question. Good topic, Mike.
Thank you.
Have a Joe. Good. Yo, yo, Joe. Have a good
yo,
night, Ralph.
No more.
Bye now. My chain was being yanked, and I detected it early.
I had my hopes up that someone was really going to go to Iceland at the exact same time you were and doing the exact same thing you were.
That was
even though I knew, you know, 10 seconds into it, it was kind of bogus.
Well, then I was like, hey, we don't know each other, but we're both from Houston. Let's be friends in Iceland. All right. 713-526-5738 is the number to call if you want to be on the air. We've got about a half hour left in the show or so, so there's plenty of times. Plenty of good times. You know. All right, Groovehouse, you were live. I heard your voice. I don't know if you told
me. I know, it was really loud.
Oh.
Turn him down. I'm this far away.
Turn me down, dead man. All right, Groovehouse.
It's Paul McCartney's birthday today.
Is it really?
Yep.
Baby, 72. I'm amazed.
We should have made Flick to talk only in Beatles lyrics and McCartney lyrics.
We've got all but kinds
can't
of
can't even do 80s.
I bet if Flick it has limited knowledge of and slight contempt for the Beatles.
But he has strong Google foo.
That's true. We should start a website. What would Flick it say?
We should start a rubber wristband that's WPS. What would Flicted say?
He would say.
He wouldn't say much.
All right, Groovehouse.
All right.
Who do we have?
Up next, we're going to speak with Paul.
Paul, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
My question is, how do I output the performance from Task Manager to a file? My text file.
For what purpose?
Well, it's to keep track of, you know, the purpose is to create a statistics of computing on Windows. I have a program on Windows that it does a lot of processing, and I want to record, you know, all the CPU usage. Basically, that's what it is.
I've never heard of that being done in terms of outputting the task manager to a file. Now, there is event logging that you can do, but I don't know if it will tell you how much processor you're using or not. And great, now that my internet is down,
I think we just went down to the station. There are, and I wish I could get to it right now, there are clients that you can actually install that will monitor all that kind of stuff and log out to a file, even like log out to HTML readable files you can just pull open in a browser. And let me see if I can find
it's back.
There's a free package.
Yeah, it just came back, yeah. So there's a I did a Google search on how to generate a text file list of running processes in Windows, and there does seem to it's convoluted. But you can do it. It's
there's some colors.
If you do it from the command line, you can type the word task list and then send that to a file. Are you familiar with how to do DOS commands and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, DOS commands, yes, but the... I never thought about doing it like that, so...
So if you go to the command line and you do a task list, it will bring up all of the processes in like a DOS window and show you all of the, you know, what process is using how much memory at that time. Now, that won't give you an ongoing record of how, you know, there should be a snapshot. And then what you can do is you can take that command and instead of having it display to the screen, you can have it write that information to a text file. So task list greater than D, you know, C:\folder/, and then the name of the file, task.txt or whatever. But if you Google search how to generate text file list of running processes in Windows, you'll find that tutorial that tells you how to do that. So it can be done. Now, do you have any apps you can recommend, Barrett?
I was looking. Most of these, it looks like, requires a server. And I was actually just reading up on using the performance monitor to do logging, like Jay was just kind of alluding to.
Is there a performance monitor?
Yeah, there's. So which version of Windows did you say you had again?
Windows 7.
Yeah, so under Windows 7, if you go in, so there's the Windows Task Manager, and you can get to it just by typing in perfmon, but it's the performance monitor. And if you actually go into the performance monitor, let's see, there's a console tree on the left-hand side. There's a tree. And you can actually click, you've got to create a new data collector set. So you create one of those, and then you say, hey, I want to create. Yeah, anyway, yeah, yo. Here's the best way to do it. I found this by doing Windows log processes memory usage. So really what I was doing is doing Windows log, and then I want to look, you know, find out how to log processes memory usage. And then that brought me up to how to record CPU and memory usage over time. And that's going to get you, it's a few different steps. You have to actually set up like a log trap. Then you've got to say, hey, I want the, you know, performance counter to go. You can say, I want event trace data to go. You can say, I want system configuration data to go. And then you set next, then you say, hey, save it here. And then you say, hey, here's the frequency. So it's five or six steps, but you can actually set up logging built into Windows. So I found it on InstaFundus was the site, and it's how to record CPU and memory usage over time in Windows.
Yeah, there's also, it looks like there's a thing called Windows Performance Monitor that has logging.
Oh, that's the same thing. Yeah,
so
it's built in.
If you do a search direct for, like, Windows Performance Monitor, I found a couple of tutorials talking about how to do that, too.
And that's, I believe that's the what you're looking for. That's one of the tabs. It's in the Windows Task Manager.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Good luck.
Okay, you too. Bye.
You know, I would think someone with a question. I mean, that's a good question. That's an interesting idea. It's not one that's come up for me. I mean, I guess if you're wanting to, I guess make sure that your systems. I know there are. We make software that actually monitors mm-hmm. the health of a system. Like you can set it up to where you run an agent on the computer and it reports to a master, you know, to a server. And it says, and you basically you program in if the CPU gets to a certain level, alert. And I'm sure it logs it all in real time too. This is enterprise management type software. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
But you run an agent on the different computers, and it says, okay, if the memory usage gets to a certain point, alert. And if your disk space gets to a certain size, you know, if you get to using so much disk space, send an alert. But also, it will log and keep track of how things are going on in an enterprise environment.
The problem for an individual, though, is if you're logging it, so, okay, I look at the log. Well, at 2:30, it spiked up. Okay, well, what does that tell me? It's 7 o'clock tonight. I don't remember what was I doing at 2:30.
Right.
Was it sitting empty? Did I go get a cup of coffee and it spiked? And it seems like a lot of that stuff is really, okay, my computer's running slow. I turn on the monitoring and look right now and see what's making it
right. Well, the
not
real
perform
time,
as opposed to, like, yesterday.
There's the same thing for the Mac, too. There's resource monitor in the Mac operating system. So if you're wanting to monitor it in real time and look at it and say, you know, pull this. Like, the only time I ever bring up the task manager tends to be when my computer starts to bog down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, what the heck's going on? It's my computer's so slow I can't even run the task manager. But how, you know, but he did say that he was looking to collect this data. I mean, I don't know, for some kind of review, but
OCSNG was the product I looked at, but the issue is with that is they're just like your enterprise software. You have a client and you've got a server,
right.
But it looks like we run it on Linux, but it looks like there's a pretty simple, you know, single click setup for OCSNG for Windows. So he could run the server part on it, which is web based. So he could just, you know, open it up and like point his web browser back towards his own machine. And then on that same machine, install an agent, but it's a little bit more convoluted than just going and logging everything from the performance monitor.
And then you want to make sure
but
that
who
if you
monitors the monitors?
Just be careful if you're
is that sort of an 80s reference? It's like kind of a Watchmen thing.
Just be careful if you're setting up anything that's doing logging on your computer.
You can blow out your drives pretty quickly
you
if
can,
you're not careful.
If you're not rotating the logs out, if you haven't taken that into consideration, depending on how often it's updating that file, it just sits there and grows fatter and fatter and fatter, and next thing you know, you're running out of disk. I mean, it's less likely these days with the larger drives that it's going to happen too soon, but I've seen people do this kind of thing where they set up some kind of log where it writes out a text file, keeps updating it, and that file gets bigger and bigger, and then all of a sudden they realize they don't have any drive space left.
I had a server that log rotate was not working correctly, and then it MySQL failed because once there's no disk space.
Yeah.
So I go in there, and I finally figured out where these logs were that were causing the problem, and I don't remember. The sad part is now if I had to retrace my steps to do it again, I'd have to go through the same process. But it was like I zeroed out a bunch of the logs and then changed the rotate to a lot lower, put a lot lower threshold on it, and like half the disk space of the server suddenly came free. I mean, it was like getting a free bonus, but I didn't like the fact that, you know, I woke up one morning and there was a problem on the server.
100% disks are always fun, yeah. Stuff just stops working. MySQL goes down. Anything that wants to write any kind of data goes down. I'm really surprised that Linux, and I'm assuming that's what you're on, that you can still connect to servers, though, when you blow disks. I've seen, like, Windows 2003 servers where that situation happens and you can't get in remotely. Like, the whole thing just goes south. Maybe if you waited 2 days for it to process the request, you could get in. But it's at that point, you just go to the server room.
But oh man, so you run that, and I made log rotate run, and suddenly, like I said, it went from like, you know, I had cleared out. First thing I did is I had some old sites that had just been sitting there. They were kind of back. They were sort of backups for sites that were gone. And so it's like, okay, I know I have a zip file for this, or I downloaded one, and then it's like nuked that, and I had 5%, and suddenly I could start working, but. Not
all right.
Pleasant.
Log files and how to tame
100
them.
100 gigs of logs is no fun.
Several hundred gigs of MP3 podcast files either. All right, 713-526-5738, Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who do you have next?
Up next, we're going to speak with Bill.
Bill, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Thank you. If we haven't gone too far, I want to speak to phones.
Okay.
I traveled
speaking
overseas.
To one now.
Yeah, I traveled overseas quite a bit over the years, and when I wanted to go, I would just, it was really restrictive on the carriers at the time, I'd just go down to Harwin and, you know, 10, 15, 20 bucks, whatever it was, get my phone unlocked, and I was on my way and get a new SIM when I got where I was going.
Right.
And so recently, I've got a smartphone, got an iPhone, and I'm on a plan with AT&T. If you're going to try to unlock something, don't get AT&T, because what I tried to do was, rather than go down to Harwin, I said, well, I'll just call them up and say, hey, can I just get this old phone, this old flip phone that I've got that used to be on the account, unlocked, so the plan where I can only use X number of minutes on conference calls in a month, I would have two phones, and so I could split the time. It took me over 2 weeks to get it done. It was online. No one at the shop at the AT&T store could help. No one online seemed to know anything about it. It was buried in some back corner, and it was a horrible experience. I finally got it. By the time I finally got it done, 3 weeks after I started out, I'd lost the SIM card.
Gee.
So it's just a warning if you're planning to get an AT&T phone unlocked straight up with AT&T, get started in time.
Yeah, like before you even try to get your passport, apparently.
Yes.
Or before you lock into an AT&T phone or contract.
Certainly before you go to Iceland.
Well, one thing to keep in mind, too, is that to that point, if you buy a new phone, if you get a phone and you get that phone if you try to travel within 30 days or even 6 months sometimes with that new phone, the carrier will not unlock it until, you know, you've had it for a year.
Yeah,
you've
got to age it.
Yeah, so they want to make sure that you're not going to unlock it and sell it on eBay at a profit.
Exactly. So, well, this flip phone, which I had for 4 years, cost $15 when I bought it new. I went through all of this just because when it was on service, it was on AT&T, so I went to them to do it. And when they came back to me first time around, finally, I talked to somebody who said, yeah, we can get that done. And they sent me instructions to unlock my iPhone. I didn't want to unlock my iPhone, so then I had to go back around again. I had to put in a new application, start over again, and then they were really confused because it wasn't on my account. The phone was an AT&T phone, but it wasn't on my account. So they didn't quite know what to do about it. Anyway, the warning. Do it if it's AT&T, unlike, I guess you said, who was it? You said they're already unlocked?
Verizon iPhones are unlocked when you buy them. So I had no problem using mine overseas. I got it a little over a year and a half ago, and I've had no problems feeding it foreign SIMs. Another thing, too, is that once you believe that you, sometimes when it get the unlock code for a phone, you don't have the opportunity to put that code in until you introduce the foreign SIM. So another thing to keep in mind if you're traveling with a phone is if you get your phone unlocked or you are given the unlock code, borrow a SIM card from somebody on a different carrier and plug it in and go ahead and run the unlock. But that gets a little difficult. Like if you're, you know, you got to find, if you're an iPhone 5 user, you have to find another iPhone 5 user so you can get a nano SIM a different carrier.
Or you can buy a cheap prepaid SIM, which I've done before for $9 or, whatever at Best Buy or some store.
Because a lot of times you don't have the opportunity to put in the unlock code until the foreign SIM is introduced if it's carrier locked.
I found that, hey, can I borrow your SIM card? Doesn't go over really well with a lot of people. They just won't. Say, hey, yeah.
Dwight Silverman would not loan me his SIM card for me to try testing it out since he was worried that, I don't know what he's worried about.
But well,
I
imagine worried. Down in Harwin they got all the SIMs they need.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly, yeah. All right, thanks for your call.
Anyway, just a warning to go out there, since it was a topic and up, get a head start.
All right, good advice. Thanks for your call.
Sure enough. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You know, another thing you can do is if you don't need voice, you can find yourself, if you can find a mobile hotspot that accepts SIM cards, you can set that up as a hotspot and then use VoIP over something like that. And sometimes you can just buy those outright when you get overseas. You can buy one with a SIM card in it with a data plan. Mm-hmm. And, you pay, but once you have the device and you can swap SIM cards out at will as you travel. But I did that when we went to Ireland rather than, I didn't have an opportunity to get a SIM card for my phone. And I just brought along a wireless hotspot and I rented it. It was a little bit more expensive than doing buy the SIM when you get over there. It was still cheaper than roaming on my data plan. Mm-hmm. And use that. And I don't ever make phone calls, but if I needed to, I could have used Skype or Google Voice.
Does the mapping program on iPhones, does it let you download mapping areas? Like you, for instance, like on Google Android, when you travel, if you didn't have a data plan, you'd kind of be sunk. You can actually go in and say, hey, I want to download this area. So at least your GPS works and, it'll show you what street you're on.
For maps, there's Open Maps. There's a whole Open Map where you download the whole map to your system. But it's good for some areas, but if you're going to travel around the whole country, visit multiple places, because you can only get detailed information once you can download an offline map, but it has to be a downtown Paris, or it has to be something kind of restricted. You don't get the whole country map, or you don't get a whole bunch of city maps. So I haven't done the offline maps too much yet, but I have done it. I have, looked at Open Maps, and you can pull down certain maps with that. But
I think it's not a cure-all, but it's not a bad backup plan in case you ever get to the point. Because I've relied on my phone and said, okay, I'm only going to use my phone for traveling, and I'll get someplace, and I'll be a half day before I can find a SIM or whatever. And, just having the cached maps can come in handy.
I still struggle with trying to read a map on a phone and try to figure out where I am, looking at that small real estate. For me, it's more important just to have the data connection so I can get the phone number for the place that I'm trying to get to, or at least know basically where it is, tell the cab driver how to take me over there or something. All right, 713-526-5738, Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who do we have up?
Up next, we're going to speak with Kevin.
Kevin, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Howdy, guys.
Hi.
I'm trying to pick a microcontroller. I have to capture printer output from a vehicle. You know, it's just pretty small string of data, but I'm, you know, there's, you know, all these microcontrollers. I'm looking for a small package I can just plug in and capture the printer out.
What kind of connection is it? Do you know what kind of printer cable you've got
it's
to connect to?
It's a serial port.
Serial? That should be easy. And do you know, is it like a 25-pin, or is it one of the bigger? It's been a while since I've used
I don't know if it's 9 or 25, but yeah.
Maybe 9 or 25, but it's one of the two, probably.
Transmit, receive.
Do you have a price limit? I mean, everything's kind of cheap right now.
Well, yeah, it's just that, you know, ideally what I'd like to do is to capture it to an SD card. I was looking at the Arduino with SD shield that I could run directly to an SD card.
That's
and
your
pull
best
that out
bet.
Later and then run that into Excel or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's probably what you want to do. There are a lot of different microcontrollers, and there are definitely some that are more powerful than the Arduino. But the nice thing about the Arduino is if you buy like an Arduino board, you're not just getting the hardware, you're kind of getting a full community. So there are probably, I'm even seeing a couple of Google searches here, there are people that, you know, have built the DB25 housings to, you know, to go into, you know, the serial ports. And there are also, you know, people that have logged that. So it's, you know, you can probably just go find the code, copy, paste, or get something that gets you really close to there and then just, you know, kind of build on what they've done. So I would go with what you're doing. I would go Arduino, get the SD shield for it where you can log data, and then maybe, let's see, what's the best way to go?
Well, but do you think a Uno is good enough or Mega? Or
oh, no, you don't need a Mega.
I thought. Yeah, I'm not processing anything. Basically, I have to qualify the input so that when the vehicle stops, I capture the data.
Now,
so
let me ask
you
this.
I've got an accelerometer connected to it, and I've got that lined out. But
You don't have to pass the data through. Like, it doesn't have to wind up in any system. It can just, you can just peel it off and that's it,
yeah.
Right? Okay, yeah. Yeah, that shouldn't be that big of a deal.
Okay, cool.
So the main thing is just go out, and the big thing is just getting that cable that's going to go between the Arduino and your DB25 or your DB9. But figure out which one it is, and then go see, you know, what it is. I'm sure you're familiar with places like Spark Fun and Adafruit.
The end is pretty simple. I'm
yeah, they'll have the cable assembly.
I'm more concerned about what how. Well, if you think the Uno works, then that's fine. That's kind of the platform I'm working with.
Yeah, the Uno should definitely work.
I'm kind of concerned maybe I needed the Mega or something.
The Mega doesn't give
something
you
a little more robust. Yeah.
No, not just unless you just want to drop the extra money. And also, if you want to, feel free to bring out the project to a geek gathering. The first Friday of the month, we've got, you know, a number of people that are into microcontrollers and into Arduino. And, you know, I'll even take a look at the code, too. You know, we can see what you're doing. And if you're having any issues, maybe get you back on the right track.
Cool. Yeah, very good.
All right, good luck.
Very good. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Rah, 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 rah. That was good that you were in your wheelhouse.
That one
there.
Went to deep into the weeds for me, yeah.
Glad you're here for that one. All right. 713-526-5738. As we wind down the show, we've got one call in the queue, and we do have some open lines and a little bit of time left. I was noticing on IRC somebody, was it IRC? Actually, somebody on our Facebook on the Technology Bytes mentioned Puffin Browser, which is for the iOS, which will let you view Flash content.
Hmm.
I have no personal experience with it, but somebody mentioned that on the Facebook page for the Technology Bytes Facebook page, which you should go like, by the way, just, you know, to have something to like.
So someone heard the radio or heard the stream and then commented back through Facebook, which
yeah.
then came back through you and has made full circle. That's
yes.
kind of cool.
That's technology, boy.
With the HR Puffin Stuff browser, which makes every show.
I just think it's cool that Jake can get online because I'm still blocked off.
It kind of goes. It kind of comes and it kind of goes. Right now I'm offline. I'm getting no ping responses, so... All right, 713-526-573. We probably have time for one or two more calls. We do have one call in the queue, so we will go to that. But if you want to be on the air in the last minutes of the show, give us a ring, 713-526-KPFT. Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who do we have?
Up next, we're going to speak with Tyler.
Tyler, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
What's up, guys? I had an iPod Nano, back
then. Nano!
The Central American iPod?
Yeah, and I would reset it and would turn on and off my Xbox from across the room. I thought that was a peculiar phenomenon because it didn't have wireless capabilities or anything, so I was just curious if y'all had any ideas as to why I could do that.
How was it? I mean, what were you doing on the iPod that was causing the Xbox to go on and off?
I would just press the reset button. It's the middle and the top button at the same time, and it would turn it off from across the room and turn it back on.
Didn't some of the Nanos, didn't they have the thing with the Nike where it would monitor wasn't there something with that where you put the thing in your shoe and it would monitor
there's an
your
app
jogging
for the
stuff, so it may have some kind of
near field
device.
Or,
yeah.
How old is the Nano?
It was like one of the older models, mind you. I mean, it was like 5 years ago, maybe. So it was like the original Xbox and like the second version of Nano.
That would not have been the MyFit or anything, the Nike. No.
Did those controllers, those were always radio controllers, right? They weren't IR controllers between the console and the hand controllers?
Yeah, they were not. I know the current Xboxes are radio.
Yeah, they're radio.
But I don't.
Surely they were radio. The
I'm sure they
were.
I don't
radio.
Think there was ever an IR controller for an Xbox.
Yeah, I have no idea.
I don't see how it could. I'm going through all the scenarios of how you could kill an Xbox with the Nano.
Well, if you think about an Xbox, so the power button's the big X button on the controller. You press and hold that, and it turns off or whatever. So could it be possible that the Nano, when you hit the reset button, sends out some kind of radio frequency that the Xbox picks up and interprets as a shutdown command?
The Nanos aren't wireless, though, right? You're syncing
it
through the wire.
It was an older model, but it probably did put out some sort of interference.
Kind of
it might just some kind of radio signal, just some kind of electrical noise.
Every time you reset it, did you get upset and throw it, just throw it across the room and it hit your Xbox?
Or did you say reset out loud and you had one of the early Xbox voice control?
There's an ad with the guy from Breaking Bad where he talks about kicking back with his Xbox.
Yeah.
You know, I just say Xbox on or Xbox off. Apparently... people have been watching, and it'll hear him say it, and it'll turn on their Xbox or turn it off.
There's the
new ones, the brand
new Xboxes. I know there's a video, there's a compilation video of where people realize that in game, if you would get the player to say Xbox off, there's somebody who named themselves Xbox off. And they said, and so every time they get sniped or killed by the character Xbox, damn you, Xbox off! Oh, cancel!
Do you still have the Nano?
No, I don't
have Xbox?
No.
So, that'd be awesome if you could actually reproduce that, like just make it at will.
Yeah,
it happen. So that could almost, if you could still make that happen, you could get a spectrum analyzer. We could reverse engineer that.
Do you have a roommate that's prone to saying things like, watch this? Totally freaks him out. And he's got like some kind of power plug. He's turning off your X-ray. I honestly don't know. I would have to guess that there was some kind of radio signal from the Nano, but I've never heard of that before. And have you anybody Googled Nano shuts off Xbox?
I'm trying to.
I've looked it up, man. They got nothing on that, honestly. I found something.
You definitely have something.
Weird. That's like that air gap virus that, you know, could jump from computer to computer over the speakers, which turned out to be true, maybe. But yeah, that's an odd mixture.
I mean, the closest thing that I did to connecting is I used to charge it with that Xbox, so... I mean, maybe had I tried it with other Xboxes, it wouldn't have worked, but like some sort of communication may have happened between the Nano
and
the Xbox.
Was the Nano plugged into the Xbox?
Yeah, there was a port for it to be charged on.
So hold on.
But I'm talking about whenever I unplugged it and I would stand at like a 5 foot distance, it would turn it on and off.
Well, so while it was plugged in over the USB cable while charging?
Yeah.
So yeah, so there's a, here's probably what's going on. There's a good chance, and you would think that Microsoft would have some error protection built in or some fault tolerance built in to the USB port, but the Nano could have thrown out some bad signals or maybe even like a turn off signal or who knows. Like,
but
Jay
he was
said,
disconnected from the USB.
Well, oh, I just asked you if it was still connected.
No, I would charge it, but then I could take it off and I would stand across the room, like with it unconnected.
I can totally see it doing it while it was connected.
Yeah,
maybe,
connected. Yeah, that's the mystery. But I don't know. Again,
I guess this is just going to be an unsolved mystery with Leonard Nimoy.
You could get your own reality TV show if you can also find Bigfoot with it.
I mean, it's, the possibilities are limitless at this point.
Or not find Bigfoot. I think because that's how those shows work.
All right, well, sorry we couldn't help you with that age-old mystery.
My haunted iPod, next on Lifetime.
All right, well, thanks, guys.
Sure, good night. All right, Groovehouse, I see we have one call left in the queue. We got a few minutes left, so we'll just take that and get on with it.
All right, it's going to be Matt.
Matt, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
All right, thank you. I have an HCT1 Guardian Blue, and the problem I'm having with it is the touch screen, when I go like to texting, then I try to go back to the main screen, put either the arrow button or the little house button where it displays
the yeah, the home button.
It won't go back, and so what I have to do is reboot it, restart it every time. I talked to the tech people at T-Mobile, and they said that the only possible chance it would be as if I were to back up all my information and do a master reset.
Well,
if
you're lucky that it's enough for it to be a software issue, then that would probably be a reasonable solution.
Okay. And if not?
If not, then it's a hardware issue, in which case you either hopefully still have warranty or you can afford to get it fixed.
Yeah, the problem, well, you know, sometimes it'll work okay for a while.
Well, I know that, for example, my iPhone 5, the power button or the standby button stopped. It started being intermittent, and then it just stopped working altogether, and I had to get I did a reset on the phone, and it didn't fix it, so I ended up actually having to get it repaired. So, your situation, it could be software, and if it is software, then reloading your system, doing a factory reset, will take care of it. How much stuff do you have on there that you would have to reinstall?
Just stuff as far as texting information and pictures.
Well, you can save off your images easy enough.
Are you synced everything with Google? Like, if you put in your Gmail account, and is everything synced where you don't have to necessarily, where it's all backed up in the cloud?
I don't know. I have the Dropbox?
Here's what I would do. I would follow their advice and make sure you have your stuff backed up. And if, you know, if they can help you get it backed up, make sure it's all backed up, and then do the reset. And at the very least, save your images. You can connect it to a computer and copy off your images and have those. I don't know about the text.
There are some free SMS backup apps that you can that will reload your messages.
Okay, we got to go. Sorry that we're out of time, Matt, but that's what I would do. All right. Well, you have been listening to Technology Bites. We appreciate everybody calling in tonight, talking with us. It's great to have Pete in the studio. I think things flow much better, so my vote is that he's here
every Wednesday.
Yeah, well, we'll have to have a fun drive for that one, too.
It is a fun drive from San Antonio, isn't it?
It's not a fun drive back the same night.
Har, har. All right. Well, you've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Clinton.
I'm Barrett.
And he's We'll see you next Wednesday night.
Boop, 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 boop.
Jumpstart your weekend and get your groove on at Discovery Green during the Thursday Concert Series presented by UHD. Enjoy free concerts showcasing dynamic entertainers from Texas and the Gulf Coast. Thursday Concerts at Discovery Green are co-sponsored by 90.1 KPFT FM. This Thursday, June 19th, dance all night long to the solid gold hit machine known as Skyrocket from Austin, Texas, featuring Houstonians Trish and Darren Murphy, Johnny Gowdy, and a whole gang of great musicians for a night of pure pop pleasure. concerts begin at 6:30. Most street parking is free starting at 6 p.m. For more details on the Discovery Green Thursday Concert Series, visit discoverygreen.com. This is KPFT Houston.
Never been a better time to donate your car to KPFT. When you contact the KPFT car donation hotline, you will do something great for this community. Call 1-855-573-8227 to donate or find out more information. KPFT is the only radio station of its kind located in the Houston area. They broadcast music, news, information, and cultural programming from national distributors, as well as locally produced offerings and more. Your donated vehicle goes to support this unique voice for others and yourself. Have an old car taking up space in your driveway? Donate it to KPFT now. Just call 1-855-573-8227 or visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle to support KPFT. Your contribution